Thank you for downloading the Pawneeville Ranch podcast, brought to you by the staff of the Pawneeville Ranch. Welcome to the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. I'm Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter. It has been a long time since I have seen you guys, and I am so happy to be bringing Pawneeville history back to all of our listeners. I think we haven't done an episode in almost a year and a half. It might have been 2 years, but we are back. You might notice some big changes as you listen. A new segment has been added about this moment in Pawneeville history. We have a new theme song, and most drastically, I sadly have a new co-host. Since we last put out a podcast, my co-host Aaron Brown took a job teaching American government to the bright minds of Pawnee Public Schools. We miss her very much, and she might be talking to a special guest appearance in future episodes. So Aaron, I know you're probably listening to this. We miss you. We hope you come back, and we'll pick you a really good topic to get you back. But for now, I will be joined by a rotating cast of co-hosts made up of our interpretive department here at the Pawneeville Ranch. And first up is our brand new intern. She's been here 3 weeks, and she is from Texas Tech University, and her name is Hannah Wilson.
Hi, everyone. I'm delighted to be in the revival of the podcast. We brought it back, and I am excited because we might be bringing this back with one of the wildest personal stories we've ever shared.
Yeah, so we sit around my office and talk about what would we like to hear on the podcast, and we always think, oh, we're going to run out of ideas sooner or later. And then we decided to pick this one obscure topic that kind of touches on Pawneeville history, and it blew us away.
It has been a wild ride these past few weeks because, like Anna said, we were like, oh, she's kind of connected. She kind of did some fun things. And then the more and more we looked into it, it just got insane.
Yeah, so if you've listened to podcasts in the past, you might have heard the Guts and Borglum episode or the Wild Bill Hickok episode. They both had incredibly wild private lives, and I think this one actually might top it. So, for our first podcast back from a long hiatus, we turn to a more modern Pawneeville history source. Pawneeville was a special man whose life spanned an incredible time in American history. He was born the year before the American Civil War in 1860, and he died right after the beginning of World War II in 1942. So he went from the Old West to the New West, and he managed to know quite the colorful cast of characters. So, today's subject was born and raised here in Oklahoma. We have an Oklahoma subject today. And she became an international superstar and an Academy Award winning actress. She starred in films with other superstars such as Gregory Peck, John Wayne, Vincent Price, and William Holden. Her life was full of ups and downs, professional successes, the epitome of professional success in Hollywood. She suffered extreme personal tragedy and also some controversy. We want you guys to buckle up for a wild ride because today's Pawneeville Ranch podcast is dedicated to the life of Miss Phyllis Lee Isley, better known in Hollywood as Jennifer Jones. But before we begin, we do want to put out a disclaimer, kind of like what we did with Guts and Borglum. The things we will discuss in this podcast are historical fact, not our personal opinion. Her life will touch on topics such as mental health issues, mental illness. We do talk about an affair that took place between a couple of married people, and we will also be touching on some drug use as well. So everything that we say in the podcast today, again, is historical fact, not our personal opinion.
Yes, and before we delve into this fascinating, tragic, and astounding life, let's take a look at a brief moment and from Pawneeville history.
Hi everyone, this is Hannah Buchanan, and I'm here with This Month in Pawneeville History. August is always a month of celebration for the staff at the Pawneeville Ranch. On August 31st, 1886, Mary Emma Manning married Gordon William Lilly at the old Siloam Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The young Philadelphia woman was only 17 when she married her 26-year-old Wild West cowboy boyfriend. May would say in interviews before her death that the first wedding was planned by her parents and Pawnee Bill. She would get the chance to plan her own special ceremony on August 31st, 1936. The setting for the 50th anniversary was in Taos, New Mexico. Pawnee Bill would simply smile as she told reporters that this time the wedding was all hers. Newspapers would estimate that nearly 3,000 people showed up to watch the Wild West show couple renew their wedding vows. The event would sadly be one of their last public appearances as a couple, as May would pass away due to injuries sustained in a car accident on September 17th, 1936.
So we love good stories here at the ranch. And if you're a fan of our podcast, you probably know how excited we get when our subjects' lives take an unexpected twist or turn. When you come to our ranch, we only get to speak to you on a very brief part of Pawneeville's life and a brief part of American history where it spanned so much more than that. So this podcast is kind of like our little outreach education division. So we get to talk about things that we never get to talk about with people. What little I personally knew about Jennifer Jones was one or two of her films. I knew The Song of Bernadette, and I knew Love is a Many Splendored Thing.
And actually, I only knew Love is a Many Splendored thing.
And I also knew about the photograph that we have on display in our museum. So if you come to our museum in the past, you will see a photograph of her and baby John Wayne.
Baby
John Wayne. I think he's like 32 years old in the picture.
He looks, I mean, it's the Duke himself, but you, I mean, if you didn't know explicitly that was John Wayne, you'd be like, is it John Wayne or is it his younger
brother?
Yeah.
So it's Jennifer Jones and baby John Wayne presenting Pawnee Bill with a pair of golden spurs. Now, the photograph is on display and we still have the golden spurs, but we will talk more about what was actually happening in that picture later in the podcast. What we found out about Jennifer Jones herself just blew us away. Like, we've been talking about this for 2 weeks now.
This woman has actually consumed our lives in a very real way.
Yes. Now, I have an obsession with the Golden Age of Hollywood. So, my era of history is not American history. I have never really cared for American history. And I know you'll fight me on that because you are all about American history.
Yes. But, yeah, the Golden Age of Hollywood is pretty pretty crazy
time period. Yeah. And it's a time period that stretched from pretty much silent film, so we're talking like the 19-teens, all the way up to the end of the 1950s. And that's where we get like our Greta Garbos and our Ingrid Bergmans.
You kind of have these women who are larger than life and have these personas, as well as having these really wonderful
and
movie
you'll
roles.
Get like your Rock Hudsons and your Gregory Pecks. So, I mean, this is a big time in American cinema history. And Hollywood at this time was filled with lurid stories of the pitfalls of celebrity, and these agencies were made up of very well-oiled PR machines. Now, this is no different than a Wild West show. Wild West shows just had smaller budgets than these movie production companies. So the history that we're talking about today can also be translated directly onto Wild West shows.
Very much so. I mean, you have these people like Mexican Joe, Jose Barrera, who kind of had this same kind of persona, just like a movie star.
Yes. And these production companies could make or break your career in an instant. Like, you could be the it girl one day and you would be nothing the next.
Spoiler alert.
It happens very quickly. So a producer could take an interest in a young actor or actress, change absolutely everything about them, and all with the hope of trying to create this international superstar. This was the Hollywood that Jennifer Jones was created in. Created, because we'll get to that in a second.
Because before she was Jennifer Jones, she was born Phyllis Lee Isley on March 2nd, 1919. Her name at birth was actually spelled P-H-Y-L-I-S. The extra L was added as a stage name in her new film in 1939, which was with John Wayne. It was called New Frontier, not to be confused with The New Frontier.
Another John Wayne film from 1935.
You know, there's only so many frontiers. You kind of have to differentiate. There's the new one. There's the new. And then there's New Frontier.
There you go.
Who can keep them straight? We can't.
Yeah, and poor sweet baby Phyllis thought she was more exotic with that extra L.
We all did.
Little did she know. It wasn't good enough.
Things will be changing later, my friends. Phyllis was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Philip and Flora May Isley. They're both owners of a theater troupe called the Isley Stock Company. We don't know a lot about what the Isley Stock Company actually did, but it operated throughout the American Midwest, and it gave Phyllis, baby young Phyllis, that she wanted to be an actor. She, at the age of 4, wanted nothing more than to be a movie star, and nothing was going to stop her. To help support her family, she started selling tickets to the shows, and by the time of the Great Depression, this company had done her family so well that they actually were able to update their equipment to show talking movies and give people this kind of escapism during the Great Depression.
Yeah, so it seems like the Isley Stock Company started as a play production company, kind of like a stock acting troupe, and then it became like a series of movie theaters. And I saw they were anywhere from the south of Texas all the way up into like Nebraska. So they had a couple of locations, and it seemed to be very successful for them. Phyllis was raised a Catholic. She actually attended the Monte Cassino School in Tulsa, which is still around today. It's now an elementary school and middle school, but back when she was attending it, it was an all-girls school that ran all the way from elementary to junior college. So after she attended a few years of junior college at Monte Cassino, she moved to Northwestern University in Chicago, but she was really unhappy about her education at Northwestern. She just didn't like it there. So in the fall of 1937, she was accepted into the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City. She had grown into a very beautiful young woman. She had very dark hair. She had dark eyes, a really soft face. She looks a lot like Vivian Leigh.
She does.
A lot like Vivian Leigh. And it was this beauty that actually caught the eye of another young actor named Robert Walker. Walker had been attending the academy for about a year before Phyllis arrived, and he had made a name for himself as the boy next door. He had these handsome good looks, and he was just kind of making this name for himself playing these boy next door characters.
It kind of became a little bit power couple-y.
It did, yeah. So Walker was originally from Utah, and he had found his way to New York City thanks to his aunt, who has the best name ever, Hortense Macquarie Odlum.
And it is as cool written down as it is said out loud. It is a cool name.
Now, Hortense Odlum was actually the president of Bonwit Teller, a luxury women's department store. And if you like Katharine Hepburn movies, the desk set with Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, one of the first lines she said in the movies is, "Look what I snagged at Bonwit's."
Which is one of the coolest lines.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
ever.
So Odlum had made quite a bit of money as the president of Bonwit Teller, and she actually offered to pay for her nephew's enrollment at the academy. So what you need to know about Robert Walker, and this will be a theme through his life, is that his parents had been divorced around the time he was between 5 and 10 years
old. And it was a pretty brutal divorce.
It was a brutal divorce, and it left a really big impression on him.
After a year at the academy, Walker convinced Phyllis that it was time for them together to join the job market, which led them to go back to Tulsa. Her dad, Phil Isley, had arranged for them to take on roles at this local radio. We don't know a lot about this radio program.
No, it just said the eponymous role, so I don't know if it was a radio program named after her or starring her, but it seemed like they each had a role in this radio program.
Yeah, and if any of y'all have any idea what this radio thing was, please let us know. We would love to learn more about it, but it's pretty backlogged in her history.
Yeah.
We can't find a lot of information about it. This job was a pretty short job. It was only about 13 weeks. And they actually got married during this kind of radio?
Yeah, they got married in Tulsa in less than probably 10 months after they had met.
Yeah, it was a very short courtship.
Yeah.
So they got married January 2nd in 1939, and they decided that they were just ready to start their Hollywood career and make a name for themselves. And they also wanted to start a family. So they took out after the wedding to L.A. to start their Hollywood dream life.
Yeah, now it seemed like Robert Walker was very convinced that they were going to do well in Hollywood.
Yes.
She took a little more convincing, but he was
He was gung-ho.
Dead certain that they were going to get married. Great.
Let's go to Hollywood, and we will be this kind of like they were at the Academy, this mm-hmm. kind of dynamic duo.
Yes. Now, Phyllis would make her big screen debut in a film called New Frontier, which we talked about earlier, in 1939. The film was part of a serial franchise from Republic Studios known as the Three Musketeers series. So, Republic Studios is known as being a lesser studio in the Hollywood genre. So, you have the big names like MGM and Universal and 20th Century Fox. And then you have people like RKO, Republic Films, things like that. So, they're kind of on the second tier.
Kind of what you would think of as kind of a B movie.
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so. The Three Musketeers is a term given to 51 Republic Picture films released between 1936 and 1943. So this is 7 years, and they did 51 films. These were not their only films.
No, this was only, there's
51 films in 7 years, yes.
But that's just a series.
A series.
They're doing so many films, so it's safe to say that these were not good movies.
They're not good movies. They're short films. They're very rushed. And another thing that you need to realize about Hollywood at this time, and this will come into play later on, is that to bring a film in under budget and on time, you would film insane hours. Out of a 24-hour day, you'd film for 20. And to keep the stars alert and active and the writers going, there was a lot of amphetamine use.
Yes.
In Hollywood at this time. Now, that's going to come back later on in our story. The Three Musketeers is a play on the Three Musketeers because they always featured a revolving cast of three main cowboy leads. Now, the three main cowboy leads in these films share the same name. But they're always played by different actors. This film, New Frontier, is hilariously terrible.
We watched a clip of it. It is maybe the weirdest, corniest. It's just so campy.
Yes.
And bad.
Bad. It's so bad. But it starred a very young Marian Morrison, whose name was otherwise known as John Wayne. And it was how we actually get our Pawneeville connection to this story.
Yes, we have no idea how this happened. We've kind of pieced it together, but we could also be very wrong. Mm-hmm. But sometime during the filming or press rounds for New Frontier, John Wayne and Phyllis Eisley presented Pawneeville with a set of gold spurs that we still have in our collection today. There's very little information on why this meeting occurred, though. We also have no idea where this movie was even filmed.
No, it sounds like in my research that I found out that this film was practically lost, for lack of a better terms, and it only came back out during the John Wayne retrospective for his 100th birthday, which would have been 2007. So there's like next to nothing known about this film.
We're able to know that it was filmed somewhere in the American Southwest, possibly even L.A., because that's where they were both living in at the time. But we have kind of deduced. We know around May of 1939, Pawneeville was in New Mexico. He was enjoying the different hot springs around the state. The best we can figure out is that Republic Studios facilitated this meeting somehow between the two stars of their new Western and this Wild West legend as a kind of a promotional Old West, New West kind of celebratory thing.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of his life, Pawneeville was practically it as far as men who had run Wild West shows, especially by 1939. So it makes sense to us that this was something that was kind of thrown together by a production company.
And it seems like a very kind of PR move
yes,
to honor
very
the
much
Old
so.
West.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other film that Phyllis would shoot that year would have another Pawnee connection.
This, I won't lie, when I realized this, I'm still kind of freaked out about this. This is almost psychically weird.
So she was able to secure a role in the serial film Dick Tracy's G-Men. It was another B movie, and it was based on the cartoon character that was created by Chester Gould, Pawnee's native son. Gould was born in Pawnee in November of 1900, and many of the characters that would actually appear in Dick Tracy comics would be based on people Gould knew personally from the town of Pawnee. So 1939 in Hollywood. It was the year of Pawnee.
Little did they know.
Little did they know. Now, however, in spite of securing two film roles, Phyllis was not able to find success in film, and the couple actually moved back to New York City because Walker was actually gaining a reputation in radio. He was a really good radio actor. It was while they were in New York that Phyllis would become a mother, and she gave birth to two sons in really quick succession. So in 1940, she would have her son Robert Jr., and then in 1941, she would have her son, Michael.
So Walker is getting this kind of name in radio, and Phyllis is, she's a new mother, but they still kind of need some income. So she starts kind of a small modeling career.
Yes.
She becomes this hat and clothing model, and then she gets back into the acting game. So she auditions for a role in this play called Claudia. I don't guess this audition didn't go very well.
Not from what I read, no.
She didn't get the role, and she left because she had done so badly, she left absolutely sobbing. This kind of left a mark on the Claudia playwright Rose Franken. Franken encouraged the producers of the big screen adaptation of the play to take a look at this woman who had auditioned for her, and it didn't quite go as planned, but no. It did create a big change in our story. Mm-hmm. We now have a new player in our game, friends. She didn't get a role in the movie, but she did get to meet a man that would shape her entire career, and that was David O. Selznick.
Yeah, so at this time in Hollywood history, it was not unusual to have a really popular play. So you would have a really popular play on Broadway or a really popular book, and it would immediately get a movie treatment. So you'd have a book released in, like, say, 1938, and the movie would be out by 1939. So really quick. So that's what's happening with Claudia, is that she's auditioned for this play. There is going to be a movie very quickly. And this playwright is saying, hey, I really want you to look at this girl. So that's kind of what's happening here. This is the point in our story where things take a huge turn.
We're about to take, I don't know, imagine you're driving down the road and you would get it to a kind of, dare I say, Pee Wee Herman kind of road sign. We're about to make a big loop-de-loop in the road, people.
Yes. Now, we get some really amazing classic cinema from this turn, but it's also one of the craziest personal stories I think we've ever covered.
Ever.
Ever. You might be asking yourself, who is David O. Selznick?
Who is he,
Anna? Who is he? Who is he? Not to be confused with David Selznick, who was his uncle.
No.
David O. The O did not stand for anything. He just thought it looked good in the middle of his name.
That kind of is the most telling about his personality.
So, Selznick is described in Hollywood as what is known as an uber producer. Not just quantity-wise, but just legacy-wise as well. Like, he was the biggest of the big. He was never interested in directing films. He thought they were messy. He thought they were time-consuming. He knew he was better as a producer. But he is the man who's responsible for bringing us some of Hollywood's, frankly, biggest films
yes.
and stars in history. It's really hard to make comparisons between Selznick and people that operate in the industry today. The 1930s Hollywood and 2018 Hollywood really aren't comparable.
No, we had been talking about it, trying to give y'all some sort of comparison. We kind of talked about maybe J.J. Abrams.
Jerry Bruckheimer.
But nothing ever really touches what he did.
No, these producers had complete power.
Because not only is he producing these incredible movies, he's finding these people.
Yes. So, I mean, he was hugely influential in the industry, and he would make you a star.
Yeah, and he could also break you.
He could break you, yes.
So, just a little backstory on Selznick. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1902, and he kind of instantly started using his family's influence to really kind of skyrocket him really fast.
Mm-hmm.
He started a huge climb in the film industry beginning in 1926. So, what age was he?
He's 24.
24, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he kind of, right out of the gate,
yes.
started going pretty hard. First, he was with MGM as a story editor, and then he went to another little thing you might know as Paramount Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
He then joined RKO Studios, and then he became his own independent producer.
Mm-hmm.
In that time, he married a woman named Irene Mayer. She was the daughter of, just, you know, the MGM studio head, Louis B. Mayer.
Yes.
He also produced Hollywood blockbusters such as Bill of Divorcement, King Kong, Dinner at 8, David Copperfield, Anna Karenina, and won Academy Awards for two small films, really hush-hush films. You may not have ever heard of them. Rebecca and Gone with the Wind.
Now, okay, so let's talk about Gone with the Wind briefly.
This consumed his life.
It would haunt his career. Like, he was so invested in Gone with the Wind. Gone with the Wind's 1939. He would be constantly trying to outdo Gone with the Wind for the rest of his life. So Gone with the Wind is, I don't want to say the peak of his career, because he had so many wonderful things that happened afterwards.
We could argue that he might have done it. It was almost he did it too early.
Yes.
Because I think he just got pounded by it.
Gone with the Wind would haunt him for the rest of his life.
You know, every single thing that was ever written about him compared everything he ever did to Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, yes.
So he helped launch careers of stars that we all, like, I mean, household names. Mm-hmm. You've got Katharine Hepburn, you've got Greta Garbo, Vivian Leigh, Joan Fontaine, Ingrid Bergman, and Alfred Hitchcock.
He brought Alfred Hitchcock from the UK.
We have Dial M for Murder.
His only
because of David O. Selznick.
Directorial Oscar was Rebecca, produced by David O. Selznick. So, yes, he made Alfred Hitchcock a household name.
So by the time Phyllis waltzes into his life, he's got this huge, long, really impressive resume.
Yeah, so while Phyllis was not given a role in the film adaptation of Claudia, Selznick took a real personal interest in this young woman. So when I was reading this story, I looked at you and I said, is he a Svengali? And the exact next thing that I read said Svengali-like producer. Yeah. So this is the kind of situation that we're dealing with. So he called her the big-eyed girl in his memos.
Can we talk about his memos?
Prolific. He was known for 40-page Western Union telegrams to actors. And then the last line would read, oh, disregard this, I have the answer that I already need. They say that his body of work, just memo-wise, to his secretaries, fills 2,000 archival boxes.
I mean, and part of this is he, frankly, like we had talked about, he is on speed.
Yes. He is an amphetamine user. Yes, he is.
And, I mean, just imagine, you're at work, you see him coming in, and you just know in your gut that you're about to have, because he dictates all these memos.
Dictates
he doesn't
everything.
Write them.
Yes.
So you know, you're sitting there knowing that he could have a 40-page memo in his back pocket just ready to spit at you.
Phyllis was instantly signed to a 7-year contract with Selznick's studio.
That's actually pretty insane, because he's never actually
seen her act.
No, I just thought about that.
This is on a recommendation from a playwright.
He saw her, got a recommendation, and said, yeah, sure,
yes.
7 years.
So not only that, Robert Walker is given a contract at MGM. And if you don't know MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Louis B. Mayer is the head of it, his father-in-law. So he kind of pulled some strings and got Robert Walker his little contract. So the entire Walker family was then moved from New York City to Los Angeles, California to begin the new chapter in their lives. When you become a big contract player with these companies, you can expect large changes. Now, this is really no different than what would happen with Wild West show performers. So when you became a Wild West show performer, you might change your name. You might have a PR team working on you. Stories might slip in the newspaper about you to make this big, larger-than-life image. And that's kind of also what's happening in the 1930s in Hollywood, but with a lot more money behind you. Lots of money at this
point.
And
kind of more publicity, like not just money, but also, you know, you have a lot more tabloids, you have more newspapers, you have more exposure.
Yes. So PR teams would create schemes to make you more exciting to the public. You might have like a faux relationship with someone, or you might have a faux fight with someone. Acting coaches would groom you. That's no secret. Marilyn Monroe had lots of stories about her acting coaches. Bad behavior was covered up. So if you did anything like public drunkenness, car accident, they would cover it up because they did not want their big stars they had invested so much money in to go to prison or to have a bad mark on their career. And you might even be renamed if your name was too common or too hard to pronounce. John Wayne got a new name. Joan Crawford got a new name. And our poor baby Phyllis.
She's no longer Phyllis.
She's no longer Phyllis. She becomes known as Jennifer Jones, a name picked for her personally by Selznick. And Jennifer Jones would take her place in Hollywood history.
Now, if you're catching on, Selznick is a little obsessed with Jennifer Jones.
He's very obsessed with Jennifer Jones.
And this is about to kind of take hold of our story.
But I think
here.
It's a mutual obsession. It's not just him. It's also her as well.
They kind of feed off each other. So the newly minted Jennifer Jones, she is now emerged, no longer a Phyllis, but a Jennifer. And her life is about to completely change under Selznick. At Selznick's advice, she would audition for the role that would make her, frankly, internationally famous. And this was the movie The Song of Bernadette. So this was a film being made by the 20th Century Fox, which told the story of a French peasant who she had visions of Virgin Mary.
Yeah, it's the story of Lourdes, the discovery of Lourdes in France,
I believe. And it was kind of a common Catholic story that would be passed down.
Of course, Jennifer's Catholic.
She already kind of
has. She knows the story, yes.
Yeah. So many women auditioned for this role. And the only producers, they would just say that Jennifer was the one they had to have. And it was often rumored that she actually saw visions just like Bernadette did.
Yeah, there's a story where a producer was holding a stick during the audition, and they kept telling the girls, like, pretend the stick is a vision. And they said the only one that saw the vision was Jennifer.
Yes. So, I don't know. I love that story. But it is, like, really? But I love it. To keep up the appearance of this wholesome young woman that she's starring as, she actually had to keep the fact that she was married and had children a complete secret.
Yeah. Nobody really knew that she had this family until after the film was basically done. So The Song of Bernadette was hugely successful, both at the box office and personally for Jennifer, because on her 25th birthday in 1944, Miss Jennifer Jones walks across the stage at the Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, California, to accept the Oscar for Best Actress in a Motion Picture.
Best birthday present ever.
Her first nomination. She wins on her first nomination. She would have 5 nominations in her career, but this was the only time she actually won the award. So first time out of the gate, like her 3rd movie role, she wins an Oscar.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Jennifer. Now, she was so nervous and distracted at the ceremony that she actually left little Oscar in the cab on her way home.
This is where I relate to Jennifer Jones a lot, because I read that and, like, I would do that, and probably, yeah, I related to that quite a bit.
So, things in Jennifer's personal life were not going as well as her film career, unfortunately, and it was pretty much because of David O. Selznick. Robert Walker had seen tremendous success in his own movie career at MGM. He was starring in a war movie called Bataan in 1943, but it was really clear to him that the relationship between his wife and Selznick was no longer strictly professional.
No, it was not. And Robert was correct in his assumptions.
Yes.
Sometime before the filming of Since You Went Away, which was in 1944, Selznick and Jennifer, while both married, had again an affair.
Mm-hmm.
To add this super bizarre twist to it, Selznick cast Jennifer's husband, Robert Walker, as her love story in Since You Went Away.
Yes.
While they were having an affair.
Yes.
So during the middle of the production, Robert Walker and Jennifer actually separated.
Yes.
And divorced while playing each other's love interests. Mm-hmm. It was pretty tragic. Selznick remained with his wife, Irene Mayer, until 1948, but both marriages dissolved because of this affair. And this relationship between the actress and the producer is kind of that open secret. Everyone knows, but mm-hmm. we're not talking about it in Hollywood.
Yeah, so sadly, the end of his marriage would be the beginning of a very harsh downward spiral for Robert Walker. So this is kind of our first touch on mental illness, and this becomes a theme in Jennifer's life throughout the end of her life.
This kind of causes him to have their divorce, kind of mirroring his mm-hmm. parents' horrible divorce, just causes him to have a complete mental
yes.
collapse.
Even though he would see his greatest movie role as the villain in Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, hello, classic movie by Alfred Hitchcock, in 1951.
The coolest, like, villainy.
Like, yes.
Yeah.
He never got over the loss of Jennifer. It's kind of apparent to me that the love of his life was Jennifer, and it will become apparent that the love of Jennifer's life was David.
Which is just, like, the saddest
sentence.
It's so
tragic. So, after a series of mental health episodes exacerbated by alcoholism, Robert Walker would untimely die in late 1951. He was suffering from a panic attack on a movie set when a doctor gave him some prescription medication that caused an adverse reaction. He sadly died of a heart attack. So, that happened in 1951, only about 4 years after he had divorced Jennifer Jones.
So, in 4 years, he'll have his divorce, which caused him
his greatest film role, and then he would pass away.
Since You Went Away would earn Jennifer her 2nd Oscar nomination, followed by Love Letters the following year. Selznick, frankly, was in complete control of her career. He picked her roles he believed would craft this perfect image that, frankly, he's controlling, and it's just all Selznick show by this point.
It is, yes.
Clooney Brown, in 1946, would give Jennifer the chance to play this kind of comedic role that she kind of rarely did.
Mm-hmm.
And then she teamed up with Gregory Peck in the Selznick Western, Duel in the Sun. This is kind of where we're seeing that he's trying to top Gone with the Wind.
Yes, he thought Duel in the Sun was going to be better than Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
It was going to be bigger. Yes.
It was this epic Western, and while Jennifer had this fun role of this half-Native American bad girl Pearl, the $6 million budget actually was a complete financial tank.
Yeah, and this would be her fourth Oscar nomination. Mm-hmm. You will see with Jennifer Jones that even if the film was not a financial success, she will get Oscar nominations.
But she won't win.
She won't win. No, she's already won, and that is kind of it for her. The big budget film starring Jennifer seemed to become a hallmark of Selznick's later career. In 1948, he funded a film called Portrait of Jenny, where she played the ethereal muse of frequent co-star Joseph Cotten's artist character. Art is starting to imitate life at this point.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you couldn't write this if you tried.
Yeah, and Selznick started doing this really kind of strange thing where instead of relying on his wife's acting abilities, he would start cutting films that you saw more of her face. Extreme close-ups. He wanted to show how beautiful she was, basically, but it did nothing for her acting career, unfortunately. Her next critically acclaimed role would come with Vincent Minnelli's Madame Bovary in 1949, and that was before she took a brief break to marry Selznick on July 13th, 1949.
The fact that she does Madame Bovary gets me.
Yes.
That is so wild that she did that. It just seems fake.
Well, and the crazy thing is, in the middle of all of this, she's only 30 years old. So, in her 30 years, she's moved cross-country multiple times. She's had two marriages, one divorce, two very young children, and she's also had a very prestigious acting career. On top of all that, she's won an Oscar.
She left it in a cab, but she still won it.
Yes, she still had it. Her story could end here, and it would still be amazingly incredible, but we still got a long way to go.
We do. So after her marriage to Selznick, he keeps picking her roles, and it's hard to kind of know how she felt about this. She rarely ever gave public interviews.
Yeah, she did not like talking to reporters at
all. As much as David Selznick loved being in the public eye, she really didn't. So she stated in one interview that interviews probe and pry into your personal life, and I just don't like it. I respect everyone's right to privacy, and I feel mine should be respected too. And little did she know that Pawnee Bill Ranch and Museum...
doing a podcast on her, yes!
It is clear that Selznick was obsessed with her, and he would recruit her to showcase, like Anna said, not just her acting ability, but these beautiful shots of her that was more kind of about her beauty than how well she could act. A big example of this would be 1950's Gone to Earth, which Selznick recut and re-released as The Wild Heart. It was followed by Carrie, co-starring Laurence Olivier, and Terminal Station in 1953, which co-starred Montgomery Clift. All of those were very, look how pretty Jennifer is. They weren't really acting.
Yeah, she really wanted Terminal Station to be a statement piece for her career because she identified a lot with the main character in Terminal Station. Terminal Station is about a woman who is in Italy who is at the end of an affair that she has been having with Montgomery Clift.
It is another art imitating life big ol' moment. So Terminal Station gets renamed to Indiscretion of an American Wife and came out at the time when Jennifer was just dealing with her first husband's sudden death. So that is very on the nose. Could not have come out at the weirdest time. So Selznick is, she's also getting frustrated with him because he's picking these movies for her and she doesn't really feel like she's being respected as an actress.
No. Jennifer's next big role was going to be Georgie Elgin in The Country Girl. And if you know anything about The Country Girl, she's not in it. So, what happens to Miss Jennifer Jones while she's not in The Country Girl? Before shooting began, Jennifer found out she was pregnant. The role of Georgie would go to Grace Kelly.
Princess Grace.
Princess Grace of Monaco. She would win an Oscar for the role. This is not the first time Jennifer gives up a role that ends up winning someone else an Oscar. However, Jennifer would give birth to her daughter, Mary Jennifer Selznick, on August 12, 1954. Her next big role would come under Song of Bernadette director Henry King in 1955 as she takes the role of Dr. Han Soo-yin in Love is a Many Splendored Thing opposite William Holden.
This is kind of where we're getting into what could be considered a controversy.
Yes. Now, at the time, it wasn't.
No.
This was pretty common in Hollywood to cast a white actor or actress in an ethnic role. It happens a lot, especially with films of the 1920s where you have, like, Bela Lugosi playing an Arab character or a Chinese character. And this is kind of what's happening here. She is playing a Chinese woman from a novel that I believe is actually written by a Chinese woman.
Yeah.
So it could be considered controversial today. There are some allusions. They call it yellow face. She'd be playing mm-hmm. yellow face where she's not.
She kind of has this makeup on. She yes. has a heavy accent and clothing, and it's all. It would be controversial today, but at the time, it really wasn't.
And this was actually a massive success for Jennifer. It was yeah. hugely popular. It was really good for her career. It led to her fifth and final Oscar nomination. And it also led to a role, second role with Mr. Gregory Peck, in the film The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit.
Which I have never seen nor read, but the trailer was...
Hilarious.
Hilarious.
Fantastic, yes.
Apparently, Jennifer plays...
his wife.
Yeah, she's his mm-hmm. wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks adorable.
Yes.
But, yeah, if you've never seen or haven't watched the trailer for it, highly recommended, because it has a strange, like, introduction by Gregory Peck.
Yes.
So as high as her career got in the 1950s, things started to come crashing down pretty hard.
Yeah, I would say we have reached the peak of her career.
Yeah.
There are some other successes after this, but this is pretty much
the This is the highest
peak.
We're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a miss with the MGM's The Barretts of Wimpole Street as Elizabeth Barrett, which was actually wildly unpopular. This was pretty surprising, as she had already done that role with her ex-husband, Robert Walker, as Robert Browning, whenever they were at school together in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie, it was this big costume.
It was a set piece. Yeah, it was an epic.
Piece, and it just hard flopped. So in 1957, Selznick produced his last film he'll ever produce, A Farewell to Arms. It starred Jennifer.
Of course, from Ernest Hemingway.
And we're about to get a kind of segue into book movies. So this film, The Farewell to Arms, was a complete financial disaster, and they actually kind of went on an extended vacation.
Oh, they ran away. Yes.
Yeah.
They ran away. They did.
They were pretty embarrassed about it and went to Europe and India to kind of let things settle down. So Jennifer would do another book movie after this in 1961, Tender as the Night,
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
And it also got terrible critic reviews. And at this point, Jennifer just left the public eye.
Yeah, she was done at that point.
Yeah.
So in 1963, Jennifer's son, Robert Walker Jr., actually wins a Golden Globe Award.
And the plot twist of this entire story.
Out of nowhere. So he was an actor. Acting is in their blood. Two parents as an actor. He becomes an actor himself. He is actually still active in acting
really?
Today. Yes, he is still acting today. And he won the Golden Globe Award for Most Promising Newcomer for his role in a movie called The Ceremony. I don't know anything about it, but
nope.
He did win a Golden Globe for that. Things were pretty quiet for Jennifer in her semi-retirement until... tragedy strikes on June 22nd, 1965. So at the age of 63, David O. Selznick suffers a series of heart attacks, and they would ultimately kill him on that date. So we don't know what caused them.
We kind of do.
Kind of. It might have been amphetamine use. It could have been lack of sleep. I mean, who knows what actually caused it.
He was not necessarily the healthiest man.
No, and he's pretty young. I mean, he's only
yeah.
63. So, I mean, at the age of 63, he's gone from her life. And that was 20 years of her life.
Yeah.
He shaped her life for 20 years, and he's just gone. And unfortunately, this starts... a really hard time in her life, because she is suddenly alone, making her own career choices with a very young daughter to support.
Because she really never had ever been acting alone.
No.
Robert Walker was with her during mm-hmm. her acting
her
school
father
years.
Helps her briefly.
Her father, yeah.
Yeah, and then
David Selznick took the reins. She never had actually been by herself.
No, and to cope with the crippling depression, she took roles in a film in 1966 called The Idol. And then, strangely, she's in a stage revival of The Country Girl in New York City. So
Which
this
I
role,
cannot imagine
Yeah,
helping.
This role she gives up to give birth to her daughter by Selznick, she stars in on stage in New York City.
And I mean, grief, we all deal with it in different ways, but I would think that would make me feel worse than better.
Yeah, so things are going to take a dark turn here for a moment. Things did not get better for her. She
no.
just could not shake these feelings that she had. And on November 9th, 1967... this really defining moment in her life happens.
Yeah, we're taking a downward spiral here, and if you do have problems with sort of dark moments and suicide, then we're going to kind of caution you from here on mm-hmm. out. After learning the death of her friend and frequent co-star Charles Bickford, and still dealing with the pain of the loss of her husband, David Selznick, Jennifer checked into a Malibu, California hotel. There's a lot of speculation as to what happens from here on out, but police found her unconscious at the base of a cliff. She was floating in the water. She had wine and barbiturates nearby. Mm-hmm. She would be hospitalized for a month, and while she recovered, she claimed it was an accidental overdose, it meant nothing, and it was not a suicide attempt. But from this point on, she dictates most of her life to helping people suffering from mental illness and depression.
Yeah, and there's a photograph of the event, and I would not recommend trying to, like, if you search for Jennifer Jones, you're gonna see it.
Yes.
But, and it's not, like, gruesome or anything, but it's really sad to see this woman who is so private, and she's so vulnerable in this moment. And, yeah, it's really, really sad to see.
Yes.
In 1971, Jennifer would attend a party thrown by art collector Walter Annenberg. She was friends with the Annenbergs, and it was there that she would meet Annenberg's friend and fellow collector, Norton Simon. Simon was the previous owner of Hunt's Foods.
Hunt's Ketchup.
Hunt's Ketchup. If you eat ketchup, you know Hunt's Foods. He was, some sources said he was a multimillionaire. I've also seen he was a billionaire. He was very, very uber wealthy. And he was instantly smitten with Jennifer. I mean, who wouldn't be?
She's the song of Bernadette.
She's the song of Bernadette. Friends would say of the relationship that for the first time, she was fully in control of her life. She didn't have someone who was dictating things to her any longer. She was in full control of her life at this moment. And from this moment on, the couple would actually wed on a yacht 1 month after meeting. Their marriage together was marked with world travel and art collecting. Sounds like the dream.
It does. From this moment on, I'm like, oh, Jennifer, you're living the life.
So oddly enough, it was actually Jennifer who encouraged her new husband to seek out art in India. So she had gone to India with Selznick when they were fleeing from a farewell to arms. And it was while she was in India for the first time that she became an ardent practitioner of yoga.
I can relate.
She loved yoga. She loved India. And it was at her suggestion that Simon actually started collecting Asian art. And he became one of the largest collectors of Asian art in the entire world.
So in 1974, there were some highs and some really big lows, and another major warning from here on out. Simon convinced Jennifer to come out of retirement one more time for this fantastically campy film that I'm sure we've all seen at some point in our lives, The Towering Inferno.
Yes.
Jennifer plays a love interest of Fred Astaire, and she was nominated for a Golden Globe for her
she
award.
She was nominated for a Golden
Which
Globe.
Which is wonderful.
For The Towering Inferno. If you don't know who she is in the film, she is the lady in the elevator who
yes.
falls down the elevator shaft.
She's... However, things did not remain happy for long. In May of 1976, while Jennifer was back in Oklahoma tending to her dying father, Phil, she received word that her daughter, Mary Jennifer, had committed suicide by jumping from a building in Los Angeles. Mary Jennifer was still struggling with the death of her father, as well as her own mental illness, and was only 21 years old. Sadly, Phil Isley would also pass away not long after.
Yeah, so this is, like, the low of her life.
Yes.
It had said that it was 2 days after Mother's Day and 1 day after David Selznick's birthday. So it was just all this stuff happening for Mary Jennifer at one time. And unfortunately, she did take her own life. However, something kind of good did come out of this.
Yes.
Together, Jennifer and Norton Simon, who himself had lost a son to suicide the year before he met Jennifer, would invest millions of dollars into the fight against mental illness. In 1980, the Jennifer Jones Simon Foundation for Mental Health and Education was endowed with $400,000 alone going to the Mary Jennifer Selznick Workshop, which was named after, of course, her daughter Mary Jennifer. It was a cause the couple would support until the end of their lives. Like, she was very heavily involved in this. She believed ardently in it. Another thing that would endure to the end of their lives was their love of art. So in 1974, after having amassed control of the failing Pasadena Museum of Modern Art, Norton Simon renamed the facility, you can guess what it is.
Everyone together.
The Norton Simon Museum. It is still open today and houses much of his world-class art collection. He has works from old masters, such as Rembrandt. There's a lot of Islamic art in there. There's a lot of Indian art. Tons of Asian art. He had multiple impressionists like Degas and Van Gogh and Renoir. And then modern art from Picasso and Lichtenstein and Warhol. So it's this huge mixture of his own collection.
He did not discriminate. He went with everyone.
Everyone.
So Jones actually flirted with another return to show business in the early 1980s when she purchased the film right to Larry McMurtry's novel Terms of Endearment.
Oh, let's talk about, I did not know that that was a Larry McMurtry novel.
It is!
I had no clue!
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it was Larry McMurtry who wrote The Colonel and Little Missy, who's a story about Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley that I tell everyone to read. I was like, hello, he did Terms of Endearment?
Yes. The role of Aurora Greenway was one that especially interested Jennifer, but producer-director James L. Brooks actually considered her too old for the part of the steadfast mother of the piece.
I mean, she was in her late 60s, early 70s.
And she wants to play a mother.
Yeah, I mean, she might be a little too old for Aurora, but still, like, this is something she felt very strongly about.
And again, Shirley MacLaine was cast and won Best Actress Oscar. So second time that she was in something, got turned down for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and then Oscar goes to someone else. So at that point, Jennifer's done. She has she's had her last touch with Hollywood, and she just becomes a recluse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she would appear in, like, retrospectives, especially for Gregory Peck, when they honored Gregory Peck for his death. She did appear in person for that. So, but otherwise, she had no want to really appear in Hollywood anymore.
No.
So, yeah.
Can't blame her.
Yeah, so she becomes a recluse at this point. She's helping to take care of Simon because he's diagnosed with this really terrible illness. It's called, I'm probably going to butcher it, Guillain-Barré syndrome, and he's actually diagnosed with that in 1984. So,
and if we said that wrong, we're so sorry.
We're so sorry. It's actually a really nasty illness, and it's actually where your immune system attacks your nervous system. So it's really painful, and it's very debilitating, and he would suffer from that and basically become more or less incapacitated until he actually died. But as he became more incapacitated by his illness, Jennifer takes over control.
She kind of takes the reins.
She takes over executive control of his art empire and served as the president off and on until his death of the Norton Simon Museum. Norton Simon would pass away on June 3rd, 1993 from his illness. Jennifer's interest in art, which she had shared with her husband, would spill over to other celebrities as well. She was so passionate about this, she got other people interested as well.
Which is so cool.
Because of her Hollywood connections, celebrities such as Billy Wilder, Gregory Peck, Cary Grant, David Geffen, Tom Brokaw, and Candace Bergen have all served on the Norton Simons Museum Board.
So Jennifer Jones lived in Malibu with her son Robert Walker Jr. and his family until her death from natural causes on December 17th, 2009, which was a very long life.
Very long, yeah. Yes. She was 90 years old when she passed away. In fact, she was a couple of, I think, like 3 months shy of her 91st birthday.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So, needless to say, from what you've heard, this was a wild ride for the girl from just a little old Tulsa, Oklahoma. While she only starred in about 25 films during her career, she left an incredible mark on Hollywood.
Yeah, 25 films.
With this much story.
Yeah, so her career might have been short, but it was very mighty. So we hope that you've enjoyed a more modern take on Pawneeville history. Again, very brief mention of Jennifer Jones in our little timeline, but she had such a big part in the history of Hollywood. But we really hope that you enjoyed this podcast. We will be back from here on out. It is a monthly celebration again, and we're really excited to bring you some new topics. So for now, again, my name is Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter.
And I'm Hannah Wilson, Pawneeville Ranch intern, and thank y'all so much for tuning in.
Yep, we'll see you next time.
The Pawneeville Ranch is owned and operated by the Oklahoma Historical Society. For more information, go to www.pawneevilleranch.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Pawneeville Ranch or on Facebook under Pawneeville Ranch and Museum.